I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the BBC Music Magazine for May of 2022, Richard Morrison worries about Russia's declining music scene. Faced with the country's destruction and the displacement of millions from their homeland, one feels trite talking about war's effect on culture. Theodore Adorno's famous line, "To write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric," warns us against taking refuge in pleasurable artistic things while the suffering caused by atrocities is still ongoing or raw in the memory. Nevertheless, the cultural repercussions of the conflict in Ukraine must be addressed, not least because they have had an impact on classical music in ways that have sometimes left me perplexed. I can understand that people want to express revulsion at what's being inflicted by Putin's regime. I can see why promoters and audiences in the West now wish to shun that small handful of Russian musicians who have, over many years, identified themselves as allies of Putin. Such figures as the conductor Valery Gergiev, pianist Denis Matsuev, and soprano Alina Trebko. Similarly, I accept that ensembles closely associated with the Russian state, such as the Bolshoi Ballet, which was due to perform in London this summer, should be told they are unwelcome, even if the dancers themselves are blameless and quite possibly secret Putin haters. What I find more questionable are calls for a blanket ban on all things Russian, including performers who have bravely issued condemnations of the invasion and, farcically, the music of Tchaikovsky and Mussorgsky. Isn't it Russia that's the intolerant society? That said, I can't see how it will be possible to normalize the exchange of musicians between the West and Russia for years to come. And it won't primarily be the West that loses from that. It will be another nail in the coffin of Russian creativity. Another nail? Well, consider this. For half a century, Russian musical life has been drifting into a backwater. The glorious succession of great Russian composers has come to a shuddering halt. It began with Glinka in the early 19th century and continued with the fervent nationalist music of the Five and the more cosmopolitan masterpieces of Tchaikovsky and Scriabin. It was maintained throughout the Soviet era, bravely in the face of horrible political pressures, by Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Ustvolskaya, and Khachaturian, while outside the country such émigré geniuses as Rachmaninoff and Stravinsky drew constantly on their Russian roots for inspiration. But since Shostakovich's death in 1975, who? Rodion Chedrin and Alfred Schnittke have their admirers. I'm not among them. And there are a few younger Russian composers, some settled in the UK, who write well-crafted music. None, however, has made an international impact to match the leading American, Finnish, British, or German composers. Then look at those once great Russian musical institutions, the Bolshoi Opera in Moscow and the Mariinsky Opera in St. Petersburg still produce amazing voices, no question, but their repertoire is governed far too much by what tourists want to see. or at least it was until pandemic and war clobbered the tourist trade. And their lumbering productions often look like hand-me-downs from czarist days. Much the same can be said about the repertoire of Russia's leading orchestras. The country's conservatories still turn out formidable string players and pianists, but the ambitious ones get out of Russia as soon as they can. Why has this decline happened? Three things: repression, commercialization, and dysfunction. Repression has always been a facet of Russian life, but at least in Soviet times, it gave creative artists an angry hidden agenda for their work. As far as I can see, that hasn't happened in Putin's Russia. Commercialization has damaged the integrity of many top Russian musical institutions, making them reliant on dodgy oligarchs and corporations for funding. And by dysfunction, I mean that somehow Russian creative artists have lost the ability to connect with the deepest pangs of the Russian soul, something that united all the great composers mentioned above. Isolation will make this petrified inertia a lot worse. Since the bad old 1970s, I've visited Russia many times and got to know many wonderful musicians there. I feel sorry for them now and for the Russian public, which loves classical music with a unique intensity, but won't get to hear foreign performers for the foreseeable future. It can't be helped. The Russian state started this war. Russians can stop it. Until they do, every aspect of Russian life, including the arts, must feel the pain. In the June 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, we get to interview rising conductor star Olivia Clark. Where were you born? London, UK. What would be your career highlight? When conductor Martin Brebbins offered me the E.N.O. Macaris Fellowship, he had to ask me to stop screaming down the phone into his ear. Another highlight was when the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra asked me to be one of its new assistant conductors. Who are some of your musical heroes? I am always most inspired by my colleagues in rehearsal. When you first find those unexpected spine-tingling moments together is an unbeatable feeling. What is your dream concert? One in which a truly diverse spectrum of people can be seen throughout the concert hall, and it feels normal. That includes the audience, musicians, creative team, and composers. In the New York Times for July 28, 2022, Ben Miller interviews the stage director of the new Ring Cycle at Bayreuth. New productions of Wagner's Ring Cycle, a 16-hour epic taking place over 4 evenings, are always a highly anticipated event. And even more so when they take place at the annual Bayreuth Festival. Opera houses most often roll out stagings of the 4 Ring works, Das Rheingold, Die Walküre, Siegfried, and Götterdämmerung, over multiple years. But Bayreuth, which is still managed by the descendants of the composer himself, presents the entire cycle all at once. And its newest production by the Austrian director Valentin Schwartz opens July 31st. Since World War II, there have only been 9 Bayreuth productions of The Ring, among them Patrice Chéreau's storied 1976 staging, which introduced critical political dramaturgy to the piece, and the most recent one, a divisive 2013 interpretation by the Marxist firebrand Frank Kastorf, A new Ring had been scheduled to premiere there in 2020, taken on by a team of surprisingly fresh faces. Schwartz, 33, and the Finnish conductor Pietari Inkinen, 42. The pandemic delayed the project, and last week, Inkinen fell ill with COVID-19 and had to miss crucial rehearsals. He was replaced by Cornelius Meister, who had originally been engaged to lead Tristan und Isolde. In between recent rehearsals, Schwartz discussed his vision for The Ring in a video interview. These are edited excerpts from the conversation. How are you holding up in the heat? Well, the coolest place in Bayreuth is on the stage. The audience generates the heat. And the building sort of cooks all afternoon, right, when people are about to take their uncomfortable seats? Yes, and I think this kind of torture has to have its reward, especially a ring which is basically 1 week of torture. You should get one big plot, one tale, one big story that you enjoy each evening, and have the feeling that you want to know how it's going to turn out in the next piece. What is your approach to the cycle? It's long, and there's an Everest-like quality to it, but in fact it's not so many characters for these 15 hours of music. It's 30 or 40 people. It reminds me very much of the typical stories of today. TV series, big novels, where you can dive in and experience getting to know the characters in a way that is not only one-dimensional. We follow Wotan, we follow Brunhilde, we follow Siegfried, and never get just one impression that one is a hero and the other is purely evil. Instead, we get to know the scratching, the deep dive into unconscious motivations. The Ring is mainly about one big family. We take this tale through different generations, through children and grandchildren and this long stretch of history within the people and this family. There are guests, wanted and unwanted, who interfere in this family story. The basic conflicts are Greek conflicts, motivations of anger or hatred or love, the will to power. This stays within this family, and that informs my, you could say, Nietzschean approach. What is the thing that motivates every person in the piece? It's knowing the end, that they will die, that it will end, that time ends. All of them are trying to find a solution for this. This summer's production will have many singers switch roles between productions instead of, for example, casting one single Wotan and Brunhilde throughout the entire cycle. Is this related to that generational approach, or is it a more prosaic choice? Like most things in a theater, there's the basic mundane thing, which is that we have not so many Wagner singers, and they are reducing in number every year. There's maybe 5 people in the world who can sing Wotan. Bayreuth gives those singers a chance for singers to evolve within the pieces. Over time, someone can sing Fasolt and go on and sing Wotan afterward, for example. For the casting, I was of course very involved with Katharina Wagner. In many cases, it's interesting to show how the role, the character changes between pieces. Irene Thioren, for example, sings Brunhilde in Valkyrie and Gerda Dämmerung, and in between, in Siegfried, it's Daniela Köhler. To make this big transition, it was great to see, at the end of Valkyrie, Irene Thioren is trapped on the cliffs by Wotan behind the magic fire. But this person is changing. When you talk about approaching the work as a TV series or film, is this something that at least partly comes from the filmic quality of Wagner's music? Most modern medieval movies and TV series are unthinkable without that Wagnerian aspect. Even in Game of Thrones, as soon as it's medieval, it has to sound like Wagner. What you describe as filmic is, for me, more about Wagner being a very practical man of theater. He knew about filmic effects long before movies existed. He built the Festspielhaus here at Bayreuth precisely for this work. It's democratic. You can see the same stage from every seat. The invisible orchestra. He wanted to have this approach. You could call it filmic from a visual perspective as well. From the structural side, it's even more interesting because of the leitmotifs. He figured out how to construct this piece as a collage. I'll take this idea from the Eddas. I'll take this from the Nibelungenlied. I'll invent something here. It's not a myth. It's a myth of other myths. And to make it not just a car crash, but something which fits together well, also musically, over a 30-year creation time, with a long break from composing. There's this narrative structure in which the orchestra, through its use of the different musical motifs, is an all-knowing storyteller. It's not a logical thing about knowing all the motifs before you enter, but something that comes from an unconscious layer of enormous emotionality, which makes it approachable for everybody. That all-knowing storyteller quality might clash with the immediacy of storytelling in a TV series, no? So much of the piece isn't action, but people describing things that have happened or will happen. Oh, of course, it has to be psychologically gripping. I have to know why this person is telling us the thing that happened half an hour ago. Wagner didn't think we were so stupid we would forget. In most cases, the interest is that it's not a monologue where someone stands on stage and sings into a mirror, but someone who is communicating to someone else. Psychologically speaking, this act of speaking is the first step in therapy. In many of these monologues, the characters give their own approach to the thing that has happened, and their position changes within the monologue. The second thing is that it has to do with the relationship of the characters to the myth. Everyone in the piece knows about the ring, has their imagination of what it does. But knowledge of different things in the piece moves like a telescope. It shifts position and zooms out and in. We explore this three-dimensional sphere of the myth and the story. It grips me that these moments, when they tell us things that have happened, are creating the past itself. You're directing this work in the house that was built for it. What is that like? You arrive and you are baffled. You sit down in the audience for the beginning of Rheingold and the sound comes out of nowhere. This experience is singular. To come to this place is also to come to the history of this place. We know that there were very dark hours in the history of the festival. They have done a good job in the last years of reflecting on these. To hire Jewish directors like Berikowski to process the past and try to create something new. It's enormous in this place how the common knowledge of Wagner still exists in every orchestral musician, in every stage technician. They remember that this is where Wolfgang Wagner wanted the curtain to rise or fall. And the audience, which is the most advanced Wagner audience in the world, they know everything about the reception history of this repertoire, so it's not my job to tell them the story that Wagner has written, but instead, it forces us to have a new vision and approach every time. In the last few years, I realized that the intrinsic feature at Bayreuth, where the works cycle and nothing lasts forever, means I don't have to make the Ring production for all time. I am making something for this moment, not something that lasts. A stone in the mosaic of the big picture of the history of Wagner. This makes me humble, feel down to earth, reminds me of what small, insignificant pieces of stardust we all are in the end. In the BBC Music magazine, dated August of 2021, Christopher Dingle discusses Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Revolutions do not need to be big, loud, and brash, as Debussy proves in his groundbreaking work of 1894. Initially intended as the first part of a triptych, inspired by Stéphane Mallarmé's poem Après-midi dans Faun, the prelude's 110 bars of languid, sensuous, slow-burning passion opened the door to 20th century music. In short, nothing had ever been heard like it in the concert hall before. From the initial bewitching flute arabesque to the final glimmer, the music appears to follow no preset path, yet remains entirely compelling. As for Debussy's own thoughts on performing the work, he was characteristically acerbic on being asked for advice by the conductor Camille Chevillard, saying, and this frankly is the polite translation, "It's a shepherd who plays the flute, out in the grass." If the composer could not resist such flippancy in the midst of a performance, it is hard to disagree with his fellow composer Ravel's response to being asked why he wanted the prelude performed at his funeral. "Because it's the only absolutely perfect work ever written." In the April 2022 edition of Pianist Magazine, Erica Wirth asks concert pianist Craig Shepherd about the piano music of Brahms. "How did you become aware of the forgotten Brahms piece, Album Blot?" "In 2011, I was giving a Brahms cycle in Seattle. The musicologist and Brahms specialist, George Bozart, is a friend of mine. He happened to call me a few days before one of my concerts, and he told me about a manuscript that had come into the market. He didn't realize that I was playing my third Brahms recital in just a few days. It was perfect timing." "Was it easy to program?" "I looked at it, and I thought it was a big deal. It's just 32 bars, but it's perfect for an encore." "What's special about the Album Blot?" "It's a haunting piece. The theme is familiar from In the Scherzo of Brahms' Horn Trio, Opus 40, which dates from some years later. The Horn Trio, which I've performed a lot, is in A-flat minor, whereas the Album Blot is in A minor. In fact, the theme feels even more haunting in A minor." "Do you still perform the Album Blot?" "I only played it on that occasion. I felt it was right at that moment in time when it was discovered. And it's just an album leaf, as the title says. I have played shorter encores, the 10-second or so Bagatelle, Opus 119 by Beethoven, springs to mind, but I haven't felt compelled to program it regularly." "Do you feel an affinity with Brahms?" "I love Brahms. I've loved him since I was a kid. I played my first Brahms cycle at Wigmore Hall in 1979. When I did the cycle in Seattle in 2011, I decided to leave out the Paganini variations because I didn't think I could do them justice any longer. I have small hands, and to manage those double notes, life is too short. Which Brahms pieces mean the most to you? I think the Opus 76 set is overlooked, and the late pieces, Opus 116 to 119, Brahms wrote them in the early 1890s. He was actually going to hang up his hat in 1889, but then he heard the clarinetist, Richard Mühlfeld, who played in the Meiningen Orchestra. He was so inspired by Mühlfeld's playing that he began to compose again. Hence, the clarinet trio, Opus 114, the quintet, Opus 115, and the Opus 120 sonatas. If it wasn't for Mühlfeld, we wouldn't have those Opus 116 to 119 pieces. Do you feel it's important to teach Brahms? I often teach his music, but some students are never going to get it. Chopin can be like this, too. Certain students can play everything, but when it comes to a Chopin nocturne, they won't touch it. I once had an undergraduate who could play the Liszt E-flat with orchestra. Really, like Argerich. And the fastest octaves you've ever heard of the Schumann Toccata. But he couldn't play Brahms or Chopin. Can you elaborate further? Their music communicates a very specific outlook on life. Don't you feel warm and cozy with Brahms? I feel like Brahms is hugging me. His music can envelop you. You feel warm and fuzzy. How would you compare that feeling to playing Schumann? Schumann is also lyrical, but he's crazy. He loved to play puzzles. To play puzzles with people. When you're dealing with one hand over the other, I'm sure he was laughing and saying, "I wonder how they're going to figure that out." If you regroup things with Schumann, he's much easier to play. In Brahms, you don't need to do that. Brahms doesn't play pianistic tricks. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for Classical Music Connection.